You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, January 8th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, just steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Julian Zelizer, author of The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. Also on the program today, the two terrorist killers in France still at large. Another police officer shot in Paris today, unclear if it is related. Also on the program, Tom Wheeler hints that he's ready to support real net neutrality with the Title II reclassification, but is he signaling he's ready for it, or is he signaling his buddies in the telecommunications industry to lobby hard over the next 4 weeks and get Congress to stop him? Also on the program today, Barbara Boxer announces her retirement, or I guess decision not to run for re-election. Also, the Democrats, what's this? Standing up against another Wall Street giveaway and effectively doing so, at least for the time being. Meanwhile, apparently drones at the border, totally ineffective. But at least we're spending millions of dollars on it, as opposed to, say, something like food stamps. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Folks, we have a pre-taped interview for you today, one that I did yesterday afternoon on a great book that talks about the context in which the Great Society, pursued by Lyndon Johnson and Congress, I guess, in 1964 took place. And then, of course, we'll come back. We'll take your phone calls. We'll head into the better half. Just a reminder, this show relies on, for about 99.9% of its revenue from supporters like those who are members of this program. So if you have the financial means, please support this program. You can go to jointhemajorityreport.com. And as a bonus, we give you another 50 minutes a day of programming. I mean, generally, it's actually a little bit longer than that. I don't think we've finished 50 minutes in weeks, months. So become a Majority Report supporter like many of your fellow listeners have. Also, you can support this program by buying your coffee from justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get a 10% discount. And if you buy your crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link. You just click on the link, bookmark it, buy your Amazon crap if you buy it from Amazon from there, and we get a kickback, and you can get there by going to majorityreportkickback.com. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll listen to that interview with Julian Zelizer. And when we get back after that, we'll give you some updates on the attack in France and a great piece by Professor Juan Cole on just what the implications of something like this are and what the motivation, the genuine motivation is. And then, of course, we've got a lot of right-wingers in this country who all of a sudden stand in solidarity with France. You remember Freedom Fries, don't you, folks? Well, now they're just saying we've got to learn the lesson of that country in Europe named Freedom. But we will get to that, of course. We will be right back after this.
You could be a shadow beneath the streetlight behind my home. Driving on 9, I sure miss you. Past the motel, looking at the pines. Driving on 9.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Julian Zelizer. He is a professor of political history at Princeton University and author of the just released today, The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. Welcome to the program, Julian.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start. There's a couple of things that I feel somewhat obligated to ask. Of course, I know that people have interviewed you about the sort of controversy surrounding the film Selma. We'll get to that in a moment. But let's start. And I found your book fascinating because it really there's almost like a double myth around Lyndon Johnson, one that has sort of receded a little bit and one that I think your book addresses, in that he was some type of legislative magician. In some ways, it makes me understand why the title, The Fierce Urgency of Now. But explain to us why that quote, which is associated so much with MLK.
Yeah, this is comes from the speech that Martin Luther King made during the March on Washington. And King was saying that this is no time for gradual politics. It was no time to continue saying, wait, 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 eventually we're going to do this, but not now. That now is the moment to take action, and now is the time that conditions are right. And in many ways, that captures both what King was saying and what the movement was saying, but also what Lyndon Johnson understood, both when he was dealing with the Civil Rights Act of 64, but after the 64 election when he wanted to get everything else. He understood his own power was limited. He never believed everyone who said he was this amazing magician on Capitol Hill. What he understood is that presidents have, if they're lucky, a very, very short window to get things done if Congress is finally hospitable to legislating. And that's what happened. And Johnson understood that he had to move quickly because the window would shut. So the quote, for me, really captured both the sense of urgency and the sense that came from understanding the limits of presidential power.
I mean, that's the thing that I think, like I say, is a bust that myth. And in some ways, it wasn't simply a sense. I mean, it was the reality that there was this level of urgency. So let's talk about that, because I think, it's inevitable and that there are comparisons between President Obama and Lyndon Johnson, both insofar as the Affordable Care Act has been hailed as the, and I think without an argument, is at least the largest change to our medical insurance system in this country since the development of Medicare and Medicaid, but also in terms of the context, the political context in which both these guys operated. You write in the book that in the 1960s, leading up to Johnson's ascension after the assassination, that we heard the same stuff about political dysfunction. Talk to us about that.
All the time. So when John Kennedy is president, right up until his death in November of 1963, if you look at the newspapers, if you look at kind of popular books about Washington, D.C., a lot of what was being written that was that Washington was a dysfunctional city, that Congress was an institution that couldn't deal with anything, that gridlock was the name of the day. And the problem was there was this alliance of Southern Democrats who chaired most of the key committees in Congress, and Republicans, Midwestern Republicans, who even though they were a minority, formed this alliance with the Southern Democrats. And that alliance, since the late 30s, blocked everything that looked liberal. There was one guy, John Stennis, in the Senate, who used to joke that he had an extra pair of pockets put into his pants just to carry around all the bills he wouldn't let up for a vote. There were people like Howard Smith, Judge Howard Smith, who was the chairman of the House Rules Committee, who never let bills out for a vote if they were anything having to do with civil rights. And these guys just dominated the place. So a lot of commentators, by the time of Kennedy's death, were saying this institution, Congress, is terribly dysfunctional. There was one Senator, Joseph Clark, who wrote a book where he called his colleagues the sapless branch of government. So that was what Lyndon Johnson was basically looking at when he became president, and he had come through this institution, and he understood just how wily a lot of these Southerners could be in killing his bills.
Let me ask you, too. I mean, that same senator who called it a sapless branch of government, was he also referred to it as a protector of white supremacy and I think it was property rights over human rights? I mean, because I'm trying to get a sense of, like, when we say this coalition of Midwest Republican senators and Southern Democrats blocking liberal, I guess, initiatives, like, what are we talking, just civil rights, or are we talking also things that might empower labor, that might expand welfare? What were the things? I mean, what were the things that people were looking to do at that time that weren't getting done?
Yeah, before 1964, it was more than civil rights. Civil rights was one issue. It was a big issue, and that's why often the issue of white supremacy was raised when talking about why do we have things like the filibuster. But there were other policies being blocked. So Medicare was something that Kennedy had proposed in 1961, and that proposal, providing health care to the aged, was attacked by the AMA as socialized medicine. The AMA would put pamphlets in the offices of physicians so that patients would get it, warning, that if this thing passed, bureaucrats would basically be making decisions in the physician's office. And this coalition of conservatives on Congress did everything possible when they could to block progress on this particular proposal. Education was another area where liberals wanted to provide federal money for education, and this was something that conservatives worked very hard to block, and they received support from many liberals from cities who wanted money for parochial schools, and this caused a lot of divisions among Democrats. Even issues like immigration reform, ending all the quotas that had been put into place on immigration in the 1920s was something conservatives were dead set against. So civil rights was the biggest issue that was being debated, but many of the other policies that we now know as the Great Society all for many years were being blocked by the coalition and other areas, labor, yes. So any kind of proposal that would benefit organized labor was something that Southern Democrats detested because there were no unions in the South and they didn't want to let them come in. And Republicans from the Midwest had no interest in anything that would benefit the union because the business constituencies in their states were against it. So this coalition really was up against a lot, and liberalism felt as if it was being, you know, bottled up by the way Congress worked.
Draw some parallels for us as to today. I mean, I want to go back in time to sort of talk about, you know, how that pent up demand got addressed. But I mean, was it? Are we looking at how similar? I mean, when I read those words that, you know, we're talking about gridlock, dysfunction, the sapless branch of government. You know, I hear those things today. In many respects, I'm a little bit skeptical of when I hear them today, because in many instances, I don't want certain things to happen. But I mean, how would you compare or contrast it to what we see today?
I think it was pretty bad, and some would argue it was even worse. So the source of obstruction, the source of conservatism was different. Today, you would argue it's the Republicans versus the Democrats, where back in the 1960s, it was a coalition from both parties that was causing the trouble. One similarity is that, you know, they used congressional procedure to their advantage, and that's something today we talk about. Southerners would threaten and would filibuster any civil rights bill that came before them, and this was a big problem to get around the filibuster. Southerners used the committee system to make sure that bills didn't come up for a vote, or if they did come up for a vote, the rules were unfavorable so that opponents would be able to kill it. And the South was an area of obstruction toward liberalism, which you could argue is still the story that we're dealing with today, even if Southerners eventually became Republicans. The issues that were being obstructed were pretty big ones, and just with civil rights, you could argue that, you know, that was a huge measure, a transformative period when there was a fight for social justice, and obstruction on Capitol Hill meant preventing the end of racial segregation. It meant preventing voting rights. Those are pretty basic rights that are being stopped. So both in terms of the method, in terms of a little bit the region, and in terms of the nature of the issues being obstructed, I think you can make a comparison. And some might argue it was worse then than it was today.
It's interesting, to the extent that it was worse, it's almost because of the force of those issues. Civil rights, you know, in many respects, you know, forgive the pun, is it's more black and white at that time, right? I mean, it's clearly like, you know, are we going to allow for a significant segment of our population to actually be real citizens as opposed to second-class citizens? So what is it that broke that logjam, I guess? You've got this pent-up demand that is building during the Kennedy administration until he is assassinated. LBJ comes, fills the presidency. What then happens?
Two things. I argue that while Lyndon Johnson was a great politician, and it's true if you listen on the phones, you're always amazed by his cleverness. What broke the logjam? You really have to go outside of Washington. And the first thing that happens is directly related to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and it's the movement. It's not simply the civil rights movement. You have a very vibrant liberal movement during this period that includes civil rights organizations, that includes organized labor, which has, you know, 15 million members and has the AFL-CIO as a real powerhouse in Washington, that has religious organizations that are often coming to Washington and working at the grassroots level behind all these causes. So liberalism has a very vibrant infrastructure during this period, and that movement is pushing really hard for these changes. And the first place I think they build up the kind of public and legislative support that is necessary is clearly the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And ultimately, you know, the more I look, the more I found you just have to credit the movement for changing the temperament on Capitol Hill and making many Republicans, for example, think that I can't stand in the way of civil rights any longer. Like Senate Minority Leader Everett Dirksen, who ultimately helped end the filibuster in 1964 against civil rights, concludes this issue is an issue whose time has come. And he did this because the movement was putting such overwhelming pressure, not just at the grassroots, but even in Washington. Liberal groups had lobbyists. They were incredibly effective. They roamed the halls of Capitol Hill. They fought against the Southern tactics that were constantly used to kill bills. And that movement was instrumental. And the second thing I talk about that comes after is the election of 64. Johnson destroys Barry Goldwater in that election, and Democrats have massive majorities on the Hill. And it's not just that they have big majorities. The liberals in the Democratic Party are the ones who are finally in control. So in 1965 and 66, the logjam ends because liberals have the numbers in Congress to pass these bills. And they're going to move Johnson's bills forward. And even if Johnson's hesitant, they're going to force him to send the proposals to them. And I think it's just basic legislative math, but those majorities were incredibly important to the breakthrough that takes place. So voters were really instrumental.
And it was also the nature of the makeup of the GOP at that time, right? Because it was the Midwestern Republican senators who were the most vulnerable, I guess, or the most sensitive to the movement that was building, because they were coming from states that had, I imagine, you tell me if I'm wrong, but large populations in their urban centers of African Americans and very active movement going on there.
Well, you have two things. I mean, in the Republican Party, first you have liberal Republicans, Republicans from the Northeast who are more liberal than a lot of Democrats on racial issues. Jacob Javits kind of legislators, the legislator from New York, who were, you know, they were right in the mix of the moral push for civil rights. And then these Midwesterners, many of whom were the leaders of the Republican Party, were incredibly important because they needed to round up the votes to break these filibusters. They needed to help in the negotiations with the administration. And part of it was a response to urban communities in cities like Chicago, where the movement would protest and you know, put fire under the feet of these guys right as the debates took place. Part of it were religious leaders. Really interesting. Religious leaders were very active in 64 and 65, especially on civil rights issues, at pressuring Midwestern Republicans who might not care as much about African Americans, but cared a lot about what religious leaders were saying. Mm. So they would come to Washington, religious leaders, and during the Civil Rights Act, they have a vigil, for example, a 24-hour vigil where they raise awareness for civil rights. They coordinate sermons with local preachers who would talk about the need for a bill and get congregants to write their members. And they become a really important force in shaking the Midwesterners. So it was a combination of the movement, African Americans in urban areas, and religious leaders who made those Midwestern Republicans move toward a lot of this legislation. It was also, I would just say, after that 64 election, Republicans are so clobbered when Barry Goldwater loses. No one wants to be seen for a little while as an extremist Republican. No one wants to look like Barry Goldwater. So a lot of Republicans in 65 and 66 are scrambling to propose some kind of bill on all these big issues so that they don't look like they're just part of the right wing.
And where, I mean, before, because I want to return to 64, and I want to go or that post-election and compare it to where President Obama entered in 08. But to what extent, I mean, was there any was the liberalism that you speak of in terms of this movement, I mean, to what extent was it in any way driven by movements to the left of that. I mean, I'm curious as to where, you know, I guess what we would refer to as radicalism, or just or something to the left at that time. I'm just trying to get a sense of the of how it broke down, or was that a phenomena that sort of didn't really begin to gel until later in the 60s?
Well, radical left-wing groups were always in the mix, and this would often cause problems for movement leaders. So, you know, one of the things that the FBI was always tagging was the number of communists or former communists who were associated with the movement. And you could always find some former communists who were basically left-wing and support, very supportive of civil rights floating around. But generally, it was really a lot. It's incredible to think of today, but a lot of these issues, like having the government provide national health care for the elderly, having the government protect the right to vote, were being championed quite comfortably by mainstream Democrats, by mainstream liberals. You didn't have to be far left to support a lot of these things. So the groups that are really the engines behind this, there are some ties to the left wing, but I don't really think in the end, that was the key. I think they were on board with this agenda, and they had been pushing for it since the 1950s.
And so Goldwater is thrashed, and he becomes toxic. Give me a sense of, you know, and it was, I think, like sort of at this point, when the theme of, you know, of Johnson sort of taking advantage of recognizing the moment that he was in and, you know, sort of going full steam ahead. I think this came up in your book. It became because Johnson is cited many times when in conversations where people express frustration with what President Obama has done in terms of demeanor. But in some respects, it's just simply that, is it the case that Johnson had that much more of a moment, or is the lesson that we learned from that time that, like, look, these come around very rarely, and so you got to shoot the moon when this stuff lines up like this?
Well, I think it's important to understand that moment. It's important to understand just how large these majorities were. Just how liberal the majorities had become because of the election and the horrible state that Republicans were in. All of this is the world Lyndon Johnson is looking at in 1965. That combined with this liberal movement, which is very much alive, it's very vibrant in 1965. This is it's a world conducive toward passing Elijah legislation. Could someone else have done what Lyndon Johnson did? That's a counterfactual that is hard to know, but they would have had a pretty good opportunity. They would have had a really good opportunity. And, yes, the lesson from Johnson is if something like this ever happens, move quickly, try to get as much done, and try to take advantage of a condition like this, because as he knew, they rarely happen in American politics. Usually the system is stacked toward conservatism. Again, his biggest accomplishment in some ways was just moving really fast and not hesitating when these conditions emerge. But we do need to know in this comparison with an Obama the kind of congressional world that he faced in those years. It was just they were ready to pass as many bills as possible. And a lot of these guys on the Hill, a lot of the Democrats who had been elected in 64, or even a few years earlier, like a guy named Richard Bolling, who was a Missouri Democrat, real liberal, they weren't going to wait for Johnson, and Johnson knew that. If he didn't pass legislation, they were going to start proposing it. After the famous march in Selma, which the movie captures, one of the things that happened is there's a number of legislators in both parties who are saying, you know, Lyndon Johnson, you got to send something, and we can't wait any longer, so we're going to do it without you. And that pressure helped move Johnson forward. So the conditions were really quite astounding. And it's important to understand this when you look at Lyndon Johnson's success.
I mean, I know it's hard to sort of, you know, to quantify, but how would you place those conditions relative to 2008? I mean, people forget that there was not a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, but for, I think, about like six months in those first 2 years, because Franken wasn't sat until, if I remember correctly, the summer of 2009. And then by the end of 2009, Ted Kennedy had passed at that point. And so my dates may be off, but there wasn't. We hear that President Obama had a filibuster-proof majority for 2 years, but that wasn't really the case. I mean, give us a comparison of those two moments. In other words, aside from the leadership styles, was the context, how much of a deficit was Obama facing relative to LBJ in terms of that right context?
It's not even close. I mean, Obama's window, simply in terms of the numbers, was very short in terms of the filibuster-proof Senate. But even the majorities in the House and Senate weren't the same kind of majorities that Lyndon Johnson enjoyed during that period. It was like, you know, they had 68 Democrats in the Senate after the election and about 295, I think, in the House. They were really in control. The liberals were in control. And that's not really what Obama faced. And I would also say that even with all the support for Obama, you know, he didn't have the kind of organized liberal movement that had come into existence by 63 and 64. Organized labor is a pale comparison today, or it was in 2008, to where it was in the mid-1960s, the height of its power. There's nothing like the civil rights movement, which was forcing the media to deal with certain issues and look at certain issues, which was scaring legislators who wanted to stand in their way. Obama didn't have anything like that. He had a great grassroots organizing to get him elected, but that's not the same as what Johnson was looking at. So the majorities were different, the movement was different, and I would add that, you know, even with Bush's unpopularity in 2008, and even with McCain losing, it wasn't like when Goldwater lost, where there's this ideological debate. A right-wing conservative said, this is the path of the party, and the nation says no, overwhelmingly. You know, Obama didn't even have that. Republicans were still pretty strong. So I don't think the conditions were anywhere close to what LBJ faced.
All right. So, I mean, when we look at the notion that we have some type of longevity, I mean, that we have this polarization that exists in our politics. I mean, historically speaking, you outline in your book that after basically a 2 year period, we revert to the mean, I guess, which is a certain amount of logjam. Is that just sort of the natural state and we get these sort of blips where things move or what? I mean, on some level, it's sort of that concept mirrors like Piketty's notion that, well, we're always going to have wealth inequality to the extent that we didn't. That was the aberration.
Well, I do think the burst of legislation was the aberration. And I don't even think it's a kind of back and forth in our politics. I think there's just rare moments when Congress is willing to do a lot. And, you know, the whole second half of my book, which I didn't really start by writing about, was 1966 forward, the midterm elections through Johnson saying, I'm not going to run. And there the conditions turn horribly against him. The conservative coalition regains its power because of the midterms, the backlash against racial legislation, Vietnam, the budget, all of this is fueling the opposition. And those final 2 years, Lyndon Johnson is nothing like the kind of great political magician we think of him. He's really a defeated, emasculated president who can't get much done and who's so frustrated that he steps down. And I think that's the reality of American politics most of the time. And I think he was aware of this. And that's why he was always scared this was going to go away. He'd been around long enough to know that. I do think that's the norm, and it doesn't mean you can't change, legislation. It doesn't mean you can't change policy, but to do so requires an enormous, enormous push, and it's a push that won't come naturally from inside Washington. What became crystal clear as I put together this book and wrote it, that push comes from outside of Washington. The system needs a huge jolt if the government is going to deal with these kind of structural problems. Then it was race. Today you could argue it would be immigration or it would be inequality. But on its own, the kind of changes in party strategy just won't happen.
As you're writing that that sort of that second half of the Johnson administration, you're seeing him lose the context in which he can do anything, and his awareness of having lost that context and becoming more and more, I guess, anemic in his ability to do anything. Were you anticipating? Project onto what you were thinking at that point. But were you anticipating something similar for Obama following this midterm election? And have you been surprised at the way the Obama administration reacted to that loss?
Well, it happened so early for Obama that I didn't really have to wait to see it happen. It happened by 2010. I'd say by that point, the change in politics was quite clear for the administration. So, as I was writing this, that had already happened. What was really surprising was in that last part of the Johnson presidency, the biggest issue that the Republicans really used, along with the conservative Democrats, against President Johnson was the budget. It was the kind of austerity politics that we have today. They warned about the deficit. They warned that the government was, you know, losing balance and losing control of its fiscal strength because of the war in Vietnam and Great Society. And there's a huge budget debate that happens in the last 2 years of the presidency that results in a tax increase and deep spending cuts to domestic spending. But through these deficit politic debates, that's how the conservatives really revive themselves, I would say, as much as through racial backlash arguments. And that was exactly what was going on after 2010. And I didn't realize quite how deep-rooted that strategy is for conservatives. And how powerful using the deficit against liberalism has been. It's been a way to kind of attack government without directly attacking government programs. It's an abstract argument that seems to resonate in midterms, at least. And back in the late 60s, it just devastated Lyndon Johnson.
That's fascinating. But speaking of this last midterm, have you been surprised about what how President Obama has reacted to it? I mean, this is it. I mean, I guess from my perspective, it seems like the administration is being much more aggressive and has able, sort of weirdly, after 2012, they couldn't get the Republicans on their heels in the way that they have now in some strange way.
Well, I think sometimes desperation can lead a president to be more aggressive, just meaning that the president is aware his time is up. The president is aware this is the last gasp of policymaking that's possible. And I think, you know, he reads the Congress and understands he's not going to get a lot of legislation through it. He's someone, by the way, the president, who never likes the comparison to President Obama and has kind of said, you need to look at the kind of Congress I'm facing. But I think his conclusion, Obama, with all of this is I'm going to use executive power in the most aggressive fashion I can, because this is my only chance to get anything more done. So it is an aggressive response to the midterms. At the same time, it's kind of an act of desperation. His time is up, and he's not been able to achieve the legislative breakthroughs on climate change and immigration reform that I really do think just a couple years ago he was still hoping could happen.
Let's briefly touch on this film, Selma. It remains controversial the way that LBJ is depicted in terms of his, I guess, I haven't seen the film, so, and I don't know if you have.
I did.
All right, well, so maybe you can characterize to me how LBJ is shown in that film, and whether or not it comports with your knowledge of what happened.
Well, the film itself is absolutely riveting, and it goes through the marches in Selma. There's several marches that take place in March of 1965 for voting rights. And what the movie does brilliantly is both capture how important the movement was to getting pressure for legislation, and also simply captures the courage that these activists needed to confront the police in the South and to confront, you know, white racists who were surrounding them and using physical violence to attack them. So overall, the movie really is fantastic. But then it has Lyndon Johnson portrayed as someone who was either uninterested at best or, extremely hesitant to join the voting rights cause. And it's basically a movie where he doesn't want to do this, where he's saying no, but ultimately has to be persuaded by Martin Luther King. And at the same time, the movie, suggests that he was authorizing J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI, to snoop on King and his private life and to try to undermine him that way. You know, that wasn't where Johnson was by early 65. Johnson's biggest fear was that if he passed voting rights, he wouldn't get it. It was too soon after the Civil Rights Act, and that the Southern Democrats, who were so defeated, would actually be re-energized and find allies that would kill the bill and that would kill everything else, Medicare, education, all these other programs he believed would help African Americans. I think that's the record, but the movie just shows a guy who really doesn't want to do this. It's unfortunate. I don't think it's necessary, and it created this debate about Lyndon Johnson. But I do think ultimately the portrayal is not accurate on Lyndon Johnson and doesn't give you a sense of just how far this president had come for voting rights by the time these marches started. In fact, one of the things I found for my book, before the marches ever started, Johnson's attorney general, Nicholas Katzenbach, had privately and secretly reached a deal with the Senate Republicans over a voting rights bill. They had the whole thing worked out, and they were just waiting for the right time to do it. So that's very different than a president who is not eager to get this done.
Fascinating. Well, the book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. Julian Zelizer, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks. And I should say, I think I mispronounced Julian's last name. Lawyer Matthew has told me. I think I did a long I, and it's... a short eye.
Well, he didn't seem to mind.
Zelizer. Yes, he was very polite about it. But so I'm going to allow one guest on the program to call me Sam Sater.
That's annoying to me.
as retribution.
I find that really grating. I don't know why.
Sam Sater?
Yeah, especially when people are like, oh, the Majority Report, Sam Sater. I'm like, no.
Well,
absolutely not.
That person you talk to has a real affectation.
No, I like when we receive
they all sound like that. I think that's what's so annoying.
I like when we receive the pitch emails trying to pitch their guest that they represent to the show, and they spell your name C-E-D-A-R.
Well, that happens. It's better than, Dear Majority, we really enjoy your show. I listen every day.
Dear Majority,
Mr. Reporters,
have you heard about a new supplement that will absolutely not only expand your life expectancy but make you a more effective worker as well? I like the pitches that are so.
I would love to see you take that.
Utterly, utterly disconnected from our.
Sam Sater, Mikkel Brooks, Matt
you.
Binder.
We've got to take a break. We're going to head into the fun half of the program. Some of it will be fun. Some of it will be talking about this, the latest on this attack in France. Apparently, one of the brothers, it's unclear to me how they have isolated the brothers. The third suspect named by police, a guy named Murad Hamid, I guess it is. Apparently, he's the one who turned himself in. He is being, defended on Twitter by classmates of his from his university who said he was in class with us while this took place. And presumably that's why he went to turn himself in, because he saw that he was named a suspect and went in and said, you know, I'm not.
Also, though, if you recall with the Boston Marathon bombing, that was also the case where Jahar actually went to school right after. And I guess because you don't realize when this is going on what time exactly it was, all his classmates were coming out saying, we saw him on campus that day. That's impossible. He didn't do it. And that's where the Free Jahar conspiracy came from, where it's not possible this guy did it.
Interesting. Well, I guess it remains to be seen. But apparently one of the brothers, and it's unclear to me, again, how they have identified the brothers as being the suspects. Apparently it's because one of them left their ID in the getaway car, which does not suggest a huge level of competency in terms of their attempt to get away. But apparently one of these guys who have murdered 12 people was in a French documentary on the radicalization of basically the making of a jihadi back in 2005, which of course I believe was even prior to the paper Charlie Hebdo even reprinting those first cartoons from the Dutch magazine. So, you know, in addition to the arguments that this attack was strategic in terms of what it would do to French politics and the idea that it could ultimately create a wider cleavage in French society, which would provide for a more fertile ground for recruitment for jihadists in France in particular, I think it's also one has to wonder if, I mean, obviously Charlie Hebdo was a target because of their satire, but I would imagine it was less about the specific offense and more about the representation as to what they represented to this jihadi. For what it's worth. When we go to the second half, we'll talk about one person who sympathizes with these terror attacks, Catholic League's Bill Donahue. And I don't even know why we say Catholic League's Bill Donahue. I mean, there's probably more people who work on this show.
Like Bill Donahue of his house in Long Island with a fax machine and email account who for some reason still gets booked on TV.
Right. I mean, I honestly think there's probably more people who work on this show than work at the Catholic League. He may have a bigger email list, though. And certainly it's probably more active. Right, Michael?
Definitely. And we're going to keep it that way with that type of obnoxious, annoying... petty, petulant, and male menopausish humor.
Oh, my God. We'll also tell the funny story of Kirby DeLauder. Do you know who that is?
Yes,
Okay, well, you'll find out in the...
what's his name again?
The funny. Is it Kirby DeLauder?
Kirby DeLauder.
Yeah. All right, the number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, if you want to be a part of the program. Folks, the app is free. MajorityApp.com. It's a free iOS app. It's a free Android app. It allows you to download the podcast, allows you to stream the podcast. If you're a member, you log in, you get access to over 1,000 searchable shows. Over 1,000. We're at like 1,050. We totally forgot to... note that we were having our 1,000th show. Yeah.
wow, we're having our 1,000th show, everybody.
Because, you know, really, the most important show is the 1,061st show, always. That's the one that we should be celebrating. This, we don't go for this this arbitrary choice of just, you know, capping it at the end of a millennium. It's 1,061st. It's really the, I don't know, we've got to come up with some reason. We've got to at one point celebrate, maybe 1,100.
We're waiting for the amount of shows to sync up with the year it is.
Oh.
We'll celebrate our 2015th show. Well, if it happens in 2015.
No, it won't.
So then 2000, wait, it won't happen for like 3 years.
Oh. All right. 646-257-3920. The point is, get the app. And you can also IM the show. Or you can IM through your instant messaging client at Majority FM. We'll be right back after this.